Today, what we're going to continue doing a survey through some Reformation church history. And today we're going to talk about the Huguenots. And so that's fun, the Huguenots, the Anglicized version. Or I should say in French, les Huguenots. And so the word that we would say is the Huguenots or the Huguenots. But in French, both singular and plural, you would just say Huguenot. And so, has anybody in this room not heard of the Huguenot? I mean, I would think most of us have heard of them just because of given our Reformed and French heritage here in Louisiana. And also, we have the Huguenot symbol on our sign out front of Christ Church and basically on all our branding. That's the Huguenot symbol. And so I don't have time to really dive into all the specifics of what's in that symbol. It's really, really cool, though. So I would advise you to Google that and do some research on it. And so, you know, given that we have a bit of a French heritage here, I think it's important to talk about the Huguenot for a little while. And so who were the Huguenot? Well, we're going to get into a lot of detail here in just a second. But just by way of definition, when we talk about the Huguenot, we're talking about Calvinist Protestants, okay? Which in France, essentially, were just Protestants. And so if you were a Protestant in France, you were most likely a Calvinist. Calvinist Protestants in France from the 16th to the 17th centuries, many of whom were heavily persecuted for their faith. And, you know, we tend to think of the Huguenot as like a particular brand of French Protestants. But basically, when you mention the term Huguenot in the 16th or 17th centuries, you really just mean French Protestant. OK, if you were a Protestant in France, you were considered a Huguenot. A little bit about the etymology of this term. It could have possibly a couple of different places, and nobody's entirely 100% sure exactly where this term came from. It could have possibly come from the term, the German term, and I'm probably going to butcher this, so forgive me, Eidgenossen, which basically means a confederate or a conspirator. That's possibly a relation to a prominent member of the Geneva City Council in Switzerland early on. And this was even before John Calvin's time. And I'm not even going to try to pronounce this man's first name, but his last name was Hughes, Huguenot Hughes. So that's possibly one origin, right? This man, Hughes, was a Roman Catholic. Actually, he was very much opposed to the rule of Geneva by the northern Swiss canton of Savoy. He opposed their rule. And he sought to use all of his political power to cast this Protestant rule off from Geneva. And he actually led and participated in a rebellion against Savoy, which led to Geneva becoming an independent state about a decade before Calvin got to Geneva. They became independent around 1526. But either way, given the history and the possible etymology of this term, Huguenot, you can see that it actually isn't a very positive term. It's associated with conspiracy. It's associated with confederacy, particularly against the civil magistrate. And this hasn't been uncommon with a lot of the terms that were used of Protestants at this time. I mean, even the very term Protestant, especially the term Calvinist, originally were not positive terms. And these days are certainly not positive terms either, right? At least around here. They were terms of derision. And especially this term Huguenot, I think, was a term of derision, which ended up being kind of absorbed by the Huguenot themselves and used as a self-title. It's like, oh, okay, you want to call us insurrectionists? Well, okay, we'll just roll with that name. We are, you know, the Huguenot. We are the people of derision. And so anyway, so what we're going to be doing this morning is we're going to go into France for a little while and talk about the Reformation there. And we're going to see how Protestantism progressed over there. And of course, as I alluded to a moment ago, the progression of the Reformation in France centers around these people, the Huguenots. And what we're going to see actually is that unlike Switzerland, unlike Germany, unlike, we'll look at this in the future, unlike the Netherlands, Protestantism fared very, very differently in France. In all of these other places, Protestantism flourished. It bloomed. It spread rapidly and quickly. Not so much in France. France put a fairly vicious lockdown on their country when it came to Protestants. And now Protestantism wasn't ever fully erased or eradicated from France, but actually because of the conflict with the Huguenots during the 18th century, there actually was some speculation that Protestantism, at least for a short time, was all but eradicated in France. And this begins with these people. And things did not go well for the Protestants like it did for those in Switzerland and Germany and other nations. And so let's talk a little bit about the origins of the Huguenots. And we're going to begin with a little bit of a backstory involving what's going on in the rest of Europe with the Reformation, because the history of the Huguenots actually overlaps with what went on in the broader Reformation early on in France. And we've covered some of this ground already in my medieval history course. And so from the early days of John Calvin, even in his university days, there were convinced Lutherans teaching in the universities in and around Paris. Okay, remember, France is a very heavily Roman Catholic country, and Paris is a heavily Roman Catholic city, okay? But there were Lutherans incognito preaching Protestantism and preaching, Reformation truths of Scripture in the universities in Paris. In fact, the very man who taught Calvin Hebrew and Greek, a man by the name of Melchior Vollmar, was an open supporter of Luther. He didn't really hide it. And so he was teaching at the university in Paris as well. And so early on, Protestantism was actually somewhat tolerated early on by the king then. His name was Francis I. He basically just wanted to leave the Protestants alone. Okay, let them do their thing. We'll do our thing. Let's leave them alone. And he was something of a Renaissance man, which at this point in time, if you were a Renaissance man, you tended to be a little bit more on the tolerant of different viewpoints. Okay, and this was the case, actually, early on with Francis I. He was even a reader of Philip Melanchthon. And so now he was never a convinced Protestant. He was never convinced by the arguments. But he was at least aware of and familiar with the writings of the Lutheran Philip Melanchthon. But over the years, during Francis's reign, as I've talked about with Calvin's early life, things soured quite a lot. And so what we're going to do is we're just going to back up a little bit, because there's actually a lot going on in Francis I's life that kind of led to this embitterment. This just kind of general disposition of embitterment, and especially as it would be expressed against the Protestants. Now, early on in the reign of Francis I, he developed a fairly vicious rivalry with the Holy Roman Emperor at that time, who was Charles V. And Charles V was 6 years Francis's junior, and he came to the throne at only 19 years of age, very young guy. And what Charles wanted, like really any good emperor, was universal rule in Europe, unlimited power, like what every emperor wants, And so through some struggles, Charles would end up actually capturing Francis I and imprisoning him for between 2 and 3 years, from the years 1524 to 1526. And to negotiate his release, what Charles would end up forcing Francis to do would be, or at least he tried to force Francis to give up some of Italy back to Charles. Now, France had been trying to annex that northwestern part of Italy for quite some time, and this is one of Francis's goals, and it ended up not working, Charles' negotiations here. But things got so bitter that Francis actually, to secure his own freedom, actually had to give over his own sons as hostages to Charles V for some years. And so when Francis returned to France in 1526, he was actually a very different man. And I think in 1526, he was 31 or 32 years old. But he was a very different man. Dispositionally, he was different. And you can imagine how he would be fairly embittered by this experience with Charles V. And so you can add this to the rising Protestant influence that is coming to prominence in the universities in Paris. He's just getting angry at all of these different visible revolutions that are going on. And eventually you would have in 1534 that infamous Affair of the Placards. I don't know if you know anything about the Affair of the Placards. I'd mentioned that in a few lectures ago in medieval history. Basically, you have this, what happened in the Affair of the Placards is you had this Protestant who was posting all of these posters all over Paris, calling bishops devils and the doctrine of Rome demonic, and nobody knew who this Protestant was. And of course, that was bad enough. But when one of those posters ended up on the bedroom door of Francis I's room, like it ended up on the door of his bedchamber, that's when things got very intense. And so after that, Francis ceased to tolerate the Protestants. And he killed some of them, and he forced the rest to flee Paris. And of course, John Calvin was one of those men who had to flee Paris. And so after this, the general policy from the French royals toward the Protestants was generally extermination. We need to get rid of these insurrectionists. We need to get rid of these overthrowers of civil government. And so this brings us to the rising opposition against the Huguenots. This persecution that began in the 1530s drew a bunch of criticism, drew a lot of criticism actually from all over Europe as news spread of these persecutions of French Protestants. And so there were many appeals that would come from different pastors, theologians, even royalty and magistrates from all over Europe, particularly from Switzerland and Germany. And Francis himself, actually, during all of this, even invited Philip Melanchthon to come and assist in establishing some kind of agreement between Protestants and Catholics. But unfortunately, the particular civil magistrate who was over Philip Melanchthon at the time said, no, you're not going. They're probably going to kill you if you go there. And so he refused to let him go, which, as you can imagine, did not make Francis I very happy. And so it just further embittered him against the Protestants. But most noble among these appeals for peace and for, you know, leaving the Protestants alone and you know, these appeals to, hey, stop killing us, stop exterminating us. One of the most notable among these appeals was actually from John Calvin himself. Now, I've said before how Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion was actually dedicated to Francis I. I don't know if you knew that. And there's a wonderful, and I've commended this many times already, and I would encourage you to read it. There's this wonderful letter that is written to Francis I at the very beginning of his Institutes, his prefatory address, where he defends Protestant doctrine. And he actually offers several pleas to Francis I to stop listening to those who would enrage him against the Protestants and stop persecuting his brethren. And so let me give you just a few quotes from this letter that Calvin wrote to Francis I. He says, quote, "The fury of certain wicked men has so enraged in your kingdom that no place has been left for sound doctrine." And he goes on to say, "For this reason, I should seem to have undertaken this labor in vain." So he's talking about, the labor he's talking about is the writing of the Institutes, which was initially meant to something like a catechism for Protestant Christians. And he continues, he says, "I would have undertaken this project in vain if I were not to attempt in this prefatory address to you, sire, to gain your ear, or at least to open your heart to the pleading of our cause." And then he talks about these men who by such means they inflame the hatred of the populace as well as the princes against our doctrine to the utmost extent. They load us with odium and reproach, representing us as aiming at nothing else than the upsetting of all government and civil order, the disturbance of the peace, the abolition of all laws, the scattering of rights and properties. In short, throwing all things into confusion. And so this is some of the descriptions of, check this out, the descriptions that were given by the French Catholics to the Huguenots. This is how French Catholics would describe them. They're not just describing the Huguenots as heretics. They are saying that. But they're really, they think the Huguenots are promoting civil disorder. They just want to overthrow the crown and the throne in France. And so Calvin goes on to say, while we meantime who hear ourselves charged with striving after gospel truth are subject to the cruelest tortures, some of us are beset with chains. You know, it's really interesting here how he is speaking in the first person. While he's writing this, he's writing from Geneva in Switzerland, a safe haven. He's not in France at the time of this writing, but he is writing in the first person. He loves France so much. He loves his own countrymen so much that he is speaking of these things in the first person as if he is suffering and being persecuted with them. He says, some of us are beset with chains, others beaten with rods, others led about as laughingstocks, others most cruelly tortured, others obliged to flee. We are all pressed with poverty, loaded with dire execrations, lacerated by slanders, and treated with the greatest indignity. And then he goes on, his major plea is, let not your majesty be at all moved by those groundless accusations with which our adversaries endeavor to terrify you. And so according to Calvin, what was happening is that the king had these men, these advisors, these Catholics in his ear who were slandering the Protestants, who were slandering the Huguenots, and which was further enraging Francis against these people, leading to their persecutions and to their deaths. And of course, this ended up, you know, not helping at all because primarily because of the Institutes, the Huguenots became associated with Geneva and with Calvin himself. And since Calvin wrote that letter, now Francis is going to associate all the Huguenots with John Calvin. And that's especially terrible, right? And so that would not make the Huguenot friends with the crown at all. Later on, Francis died in 1547, which would lead his son, Henry II, to ascend the throne in France. And now you can imagine being Francis I's son, right? Being raised in the household of Francis I, Henry II, I mean, what other way do you think Henry II knows how to deal with these Protestants? You think he knows, like, diplomacy? You think he's like, oh, I want to negotiate with you guys? No, the only way he knew how to deal with the Protestants was viciously. And so, because he learned from his own father that that's how you deal with these people. And so the Huguenots, in his eyes, were seen as both heretics and political rebels against the crown of France. And so what Henry II would do is he would establish inquisitions in various cities throughout France to root out Protestants, to torture them, and ultimately to execute them. Now, the method of torture and the method of execution is going to change a little bit. And I wish we had more time to... I was going to originally talk about some of the methods they used to torture and persecute the Huguenots. They're especially terrible, but would be beneficial for us to know about. I just don't have time to do it today. I will tell you this. The main method that they used to persecute the Huguenots was burning at the stake. That was the most widely used method of execution. And now moving on in history, Henry II dies in 1559, and his successor, his brother, Francis II, would take the throne, but he was a minor. He was only 15 years old when he took the throne, and so he would only rule really for about a year and a half. And then after he died in 1560, his even younger brother, Charles IX, would become king, And he was actually only 10 years old when he took the throne of all of France. And so, you know, what would happen is whenever you had monarchs who were this young taking the throne, they would actually have what was called a regent with them. And this regent is somebody who would basically make all the decisions and who would rule in their place until they were old enough to rule. And in this case, the regent was Charles IX's mother, Catherine de' Medici, and who would then deal with the Huguenot. Okay, she's of the Medici family. If you don't know, they're pretty well-known, famous family in this point in time. And so that's Charles IX's mother, Catherine de' Medici. And now what's interesting here is that Catherine would attempt a compromise with the Huguenot. You know, it's one of the things that makes this time, I'm sure, so confusing for the Huguenot is if you have, depending on who was in power, you know, you would have maybe a little bit, you know, somebody who was a little bit more tending towards compromise at one point in time. And then all of a sudden that person dies. And then you have somebody who would take the throne who was absolutely vicious and had no interest in compromise. And you can see how difficult that would be on these Protestants, on these families, right? And so Catherine, who was Charles IX's regent, was one that wanted to have make some kind of compromise with the Huguenot. And the first attempt at compromise happened in January of 1562, and it's the Edict of Saint Germain. There were terms that were established for the Huguenot here. So here are the terms that we can have a compromise. You can worship, you can serve God in the way you believe you need to, but we have some rules for you, okay, if you want to worship peacefully. For one, you can worship, but you cannot worship within city walls, okay? That was one of the rules that they had to abide by. They could worship, but they couldn't do it within city limits, essentially. They also could not gather at night, which makes sense, right? Usually when you have large gatherings of people at night, it's usually not for a good thing, right? Of course, in this case, it would have been a good thing, but it usually not seen as a good thing. And so they couldn't worship within city walls. They couldn't gather at night, and they also couldn't bear arms. And the goal of this was obvious, right? Catherine did not even want the possibility of the Huguenot coming together, bearing arms against the civil magistrate. Now, of course, as many compromises go, this embittered actually both sides of the aisle, both Catholic and Protestant. For the Huguenot, they thought, this is too much of a compromise for our own rights and liberties. And the French Catholics thought that, well, this is just an attempt to tolerate heretics. How much liberty are you giving these guys? And right. And so there was this was where a particularly troublesome noble French family. And when I say noble, I'm not talking about noble in character. I'm just talking about that they were part of the nobility. And this is when they enter the picture. And this is the Guise family. The Guise family, and if you want to know how that's spelled, it's G-U-I-S-E. It's French here, not geese like G-E-E-S-E, G-U-I-S-E. And so the Guise family were a staunchly Roman Catholic family, noble family in France. They held a lot of power, and they were not happy at all with the Edict of Saint-Germain. And so what they did on March 1st of 1562 in the city of Vassy, some Huguenots were discovered worshiping in the city. Now, it was during the day, but the problem was that it was within city walls, which was against the law. And so the army of Francis, not Francis the First, but he's passed away already, but another man named Francis, who was the a Duke of Guise, he was part of that family, he went in and slaughtered, along with his army, more than 60 men and women and children in the town of Vassy. And this became known as the Massacre of Vassy. And this would actually be the first conflict in what would be a nearly four decades long, essentially a civil war, would break out over this in France, and it would come to be known as the French Wars of Religion. And now, before we get to the French Wars of Religion, are there any questions or comments about the Huguenot thus far?
Yeah,
Is this even remotely interesting? I hope so. Okay, good. All right, well, let's go into the French Wars of Religion for a few moments. Started in 1562, which the reason that's the case is because that's when the Massacre of Vassy was. Going all the way almost four decades, 36 years ahead to 1598. Now, you have to understand something about the French Wars of Religion. It wasn't like a continuous 36 years of war. It was actually a series of punctuated conflicts, and some were much worse than others. And if you look at the conflicts of the French Wars of Religion, it's actually made up of eight major conflicts. And after this massacre at Vassy, the Huguenots really had no choice but to take up arms and gather themselves together in a military fashion. And this wasn't out of an interest to rebel against the monarchy. Really, this was self-defense on their part and just trying to keep from getting slaughtered, right? And so they took up arms. And these wars of religion actually became something of an international conflict. The monarchy tried to maintain control in France. They tried to keep things from getting out of hand, and they tried, at least at some points, to try to work out some kind of end to the violence. But what would happen is that people from other nations, leaders, magistrates, pastors, bishops, they would throw their support either behind the French Catholics and the monarchy or behind the Protestant Huguenot. And the real violence in France, you know, I've already mentioned these people, were perpetuated specifically by the House of Guise. They were supported by foreign Catholic nations. So other foreign Catholic nations supported this family and funneled money to this family. Spain, they did that. The Swiss canton of Savoy, they were major supporters of the Guise family. Protestants also had some international support. Particularly from the Dutch Republic. And they actually had support from England as well, which at this time, although they were still by at least a lot of outward appearances a Catholic, they had at least formally broken with the Roman Catholic Church because of Henry VIII, which we'll talk about some other time. But this became, again, an international conflict. Many people involved, many people would throw their support behind one party or another. Now, one misconception that I want to at least deal with that might perhaps be in your mind about the Huguenot, you might understand or you may see these Huguenot people as totally defenseless martyrs, as if they were just fish in a barrel in France. They were just getting massacred left and right. Well, of course, they were being massacred. They were martyrs, but they were not defenseless. Again, they took up arms. And sometimes the Huguenots actually went on the offensive. They actually went on the offensive, and you know, it wasn't entirely defensive on their part. They would actually lead attacks against Catholics, right? They would actually eventually were headed up by military leaders that were once leaders in the French army under Francis I and Henry II. And one such leader was a man by the name, and we'll talk about him a little more in just a second, but an admiral by the name of Gaspard de Coligny. And he was a major French military leader, and he led a lot of military endeavors under Francis I and Henry II. But somewhere around 1559, 1560, he converted to Protestantism. And so when the war broke out, when the Civil War, the French Wars of Religion broke out in 1562, he put himself behind the Huguenot cause. And he actually ended up leading them militarily. And so these French Wars of Religion were more of a back and forth sort of war. You know, French Catholics would attack the Huguenot, and then the Huguenot would attack the French Catholics, you know, back and forth. But the most vicious and infamous attack against the Huguenot happened in 1572. And you may have heard of this. This has become known as the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre. Bartholomew's Day Massacre. Now, let's just talk about that for a few moments. A little bit of background for what kind of led to this massacre. At several points during these French Wars of Religion, truces would be made. Okay? They would be a ceasefire. Now, what they would discover and what we now know as now is that these truces were actually quite fragile. It would take like almost nothing to stop these truces and for the fighting to happen again. The truces were at a very, on a very surface level. They really didn't do any long-term good, and they wouldn't last very long. In the year 1570, one such treaty was entered upon, and that is the treaty, not the Edict of Saint-Germain, but the Treaty of Saint-Germain-en-Laye. That was a treaty that was entered upon in August of 1570. And the parties, the representative parties of this treaty, were the Huguenot leader, Gaspard de Coligny, and the King of France, Charles IX, who was at this point 20 years old. Now, one of the conditions of this treaty of peace between the Catholics and the Protestants was the marriage of two prominent figures from both parties. Okay, this is fairly common in these days. This is how alliances were established between nations. We'd have one noble from this country marry a noble of another country, and there you go, you have an alliance. And so usually, you would have these royals from both nations marry one another, and this was what was being attempted here. And so you have a Huguenot, Henry of Navarre, and then you have the sister of King Charles IX, who was a Catholic, Margaret of Valois. And that was one of the conditions of this treaty, is that those two would have to be married, thus ostensibly uniting the Catholics and the Protestants and ending the violence. Okay. Now, hopefully some of you are at least starting to tense up a bit. And you can, given the way the French wars of religion have gone thus far, you can see how this is probably not going to end up well, right? And in fact, it did not. The problem here is that these two people, especially given their prominence, they have to be married publicly, okay? Where is the most logical place for these two to be married? What's the most logical city in which these two need to be married? Paris. They need to be married in Paris. And now here's the thing about weddings. All of us, have been to a wedding or two, I'm sure. When you have a wedding, who is in the crowd? Well, you have visitors and friends and family members from the groom's side, and you have visitors and families and friends from the bride's side, right? And so, and this was no different than this wedding of Henry and Margaret. And so in Paris, on August 18th of 1572, this is when the wedding was scheduled, you have many prominent Huguenots coming to Paris to see this wedding. And you also have, you got to think about this. Paris is itself a staunchly Roman Catholic city. And so just 4 days, the wedding takes place, and you have all these people during these 4 days who are just somehow living at peace with one another, at least, for a little while. And so the wedding happens, and 4 days after the wedding, on August 22nd, an assassination attempt was made upon Gaspard de Coligny. He was shot from a far window, and he was injured pretty severely, but he did survive. And of course, news about this spread very, very quickly in Paris. It outraged the Huguenots, and they threatened retaliation if something wasn't done about this. Now, Catherine de Medici, again, the mother of then King Charles IX, she feared that she would be suspected as having part in this assassination attempt. And it's actually very likely that she did. And so what she did is she convinced her son, Charles IX, to take preemptive action against the Huguenots. And so we're just going to go on the offensive now. And so on August 24th, 1572, St. Bartholomew's Day, in the early hours of the morning, royal guards led by a man named Henri, of course, of our good friends, the House of Guise, they found Gaspard de Coligny and they finished him off. Okay, he was shot and injured, but then they found him and they killed him. And several others were targeted and taken out as well. And this, of course, was intended to be a small operation. Now, of course, why in the world would anybody expect this to just be a small operation? Things quickly got out of hand. And because of this attack, Catholic mobs in Paris actually let loose against the Huguenots. There were several days of violence. Shops were looted. People were murdered. Mutilated bodies were dumped into the Seine River that runs right through the middle of Paris. And unfortunately, even though Charles IX ordered the killing to stop, it not only continued in Paris for a few days, it actually spread to other major French cities as well. Cities like Rouen and Lyon, Orléans, Bordeaux, all of these cities started experiencing that same kind of violence. And in some cases, this persecution and killing lasted for months. And the result is that in Paris alone, some 3,000 Huguenots were slaughtered. Some estimate that throughout France during this time, because of the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, some 70,000 Huguenots were murdered. And because of this, I mean, Huguenot morale was decimated. They just were not motivated. Leadership was all but demolished, especially after the assassination of Gaspard de Coligny. And some actually ended up converting to Catholicism, at least outwardly, for the sake of their lives. Many fled. Many of the Huguenots fled to England, some to Germany, some to the Netherlands. And as you could expect, those Huguenots who remained in France and remained Protestant ended up becoming so severely radicalized because of this, and understandably so. And so this proved really to be a significant turning point in Protestant, not just in France, but in Protestant Europe. No longer was Catholicism seen to be mainly a spiritual threat only. But actually, Roman Catholicism was now seen as a fanatical and bloodthirsty political machine. And as things would turn out, that actually, in fact, was the case. It's estimated that anywhere between 2 and 4 million people died as the result of the French Wars of Religion, really one of the deadliest conflicts recorded in human history. And later on in the Edict of Nantes, that was signed, that granted religious toleration to the Huguenots. But that was revoked 70 years later by Louis XIV in 1685. Then nearly 500,000 French Protestants were killed after that. And since then, the population of the Huguenots has dwindled in France, even to this very day. Actually, if you look at France today, I mean, how much of France is actually Protestant? Well, last figures I saw, it was 3%. 3%. And as far as I'm aware, that 3% is actually pretty strongly evangelical because given all this history, if you're going to be a Protestant in France, you really had to be a Protestant. You really had to be committed. And, you know, just compare that to Germany today. Germany today is almost one quarter Protestant, 23%. Now, I know there's a lot of liberalization and all of that. But the point is that you can see the ripple of these ripple effects throughout history, that France, even today, is almost entirely Roman Catholic. What's that?
Muslim.
Well, that's quickly happening too, yes. But, you know, just like here in Acadiana, our people here in Acadiana are almost entirely Roman Catholic, right? At least that's what they'll put on a sheet, right? And so let me end with just a few concluding remarks and lessons that we can learn from the Huguenots. The first thing I want to impress upon your hearts this morning is to pray for modern-day Huguenots, of which I think we are a part, okay? That's why we have that Huguenot symbol on our sign. You know, many of us are of French descent, and we're Protestant and Reformed. And many other Christians today, I mean, we're not currently being persecuted, but there are a lot of other people who are not French and who do not share that particular heritage who would be modern-day Huguenots who are being persecuted just like the Huguenots were. And so we need to pray for them as well, okay? I just want to read something to you from Gaspard de Coligny before we end. And this is what he wrote to his family just a couple of years before he was assassinated. This is what he says about the rising Huguenot conflict. He says, "We must follow Jesus Christ, our captain, who has marched before us. Men have stripped us of all they could, and if this is still the will of God, we shall be happy and our condition good. Seeing this loss has not happened through any injury we have done to those who have inflicted it, but solely through the hatred they bear toward me, because it has pleased God to make use of me to aid his church. For the present, it suffices that I admonish and conjure you in the name of God to persevere or to persevere courageously in the study of virtue." And so, amen. And so I'll just leave you with those words and these words from Peter, from 1 Peter 4, verses 13 to 17, as we reflect upon these things. Peter says, "Don't be surprised about the fiery trial, but rather rejoice that you share in the sufferings of Christ, so that you may be overjoyed at the revelation of his glory. If you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the the glory of God rests on you. Indeed, none of you should suffer as a murderer or a thief or wrongdoer or even as a meddler. But if you suffer as a Christian, do not be ashamed, but glorify God that you bear that name." Amen. That was the attitude of the Huguenot. And by God's grace, whatever may come in our future, let that be our attitude as well. Amen. Amen. You're dismissed. Have a great Lord's Day.